Welcome, everybody, to episode number 14 of the Wonder and Awe podcast. I'm Louis Schwartzberg, and I'm going to be your host. And a lot of you know me from the films I make that celebrate life, making the invisible visible by taking viewers on journeys through time and scale, like my recent film, Fantastic Fungi. My work has always combined the how of science and the why of art. And this podcast fills that intersection. And what I've learned over many years of personal experience and filmmaking is that being immersed in nature increases our capacity for courage, creativity, kindness, and compassion, the components we need in order to create a world for life to flourish. I also want to invite you to share your questions for our guests throughout the live broadcast. Please submit your question in the comment section off to the right. Our team will be reading them, and we're going to try to get to as many as we can. Just as nature provides us with a connection to something larger than us, playing and listening to music can help us tap into something sublime. And today's podcast will focus on music, which, like nature, can create pathways to healing. My guest today has created beautiful music for the world to enjoy. Today, I'm proud to welcome Cosmo Sheldrake to the podcast. Cosmo is a London-based multi-instrumentalist musician, composer, and producer. Cosmo released his first single, The Moss, in 2014, which was followed by The Pelican's We, an EP in 2015, and his debut album, The Much, Much, How, How, and I, in April 2018. Cosmo collaborated with Bernie Krause at the Great Animal Orchestra exhibition at Foundation Cartier in Paris. And in 2019, he released a series of wake-up calls, pieces composed entirely from recordings of endangered British birds. He's toured internationally, composed music for film and theater, and in 2015, he ran a community choir in Brighton. He releases music through his own label, Tardigrade Records. Welcome, Cosmo.
Thanks for having me.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good.
That's great. I've had a chance to interview your dad, Rupert, and also Merlin. And I know you grew up in a music and natural world surrounding you. I mean, your dad's a biologist. Your mother also teaches Mongolian overtone chanting. And you began, I think, playing the piano at 4 years old. And now you're making beautiful music that incorporates nature. And your brother wrote Entangled Life, a book about fungi. Can you talk about the influence your parents had in helping cultivate your creativity and love of the natural world?
Well, I guess I grew up, so my dad's quite a sort of, I guess, a naturalist as well as a biologist. So I grew up spending a lot of time outside identifying different plants or trees or and birds. I mean, he always used to refer to me as the family bird spotter. So I was always encouraged to learn to try and identify birds by their song and also just visually as well. So yeah, we just grew up in a environment that was really just immersed in a kind of his particular kind of understanding of the natural world and sort of almost animistic, I guess. The world is very much alive and kicking, not a kind of mechanical process. And then with my mum's, I've always been surrounded by this. She teaches workshops in Mongolian overtone chanting, so, and many other things, but you'll often hear this kind of wafting up, this sort of chanting coming through the floorboards, and she's doing her workshops or very obscure kind of sounds. And then she years ago worked with the electronic music composer and pioneer of electronic music, Karlheinz Stockhausen, and so there's just always been this strong kind of musical flavor. Also, my dad's a pianist and plays Bach mainly, but I mean all sorts. But so I grew up with kind of music very much everywhere, and then I was also Merlin, being a biologist as well, or a mycologist, just very much immersed. And also my education, I studied anthropology, but particularly focused on sort of scientists as my main, or science as my main sort of like area.
Well, I know from like the books I've read that your dad wrote, I mean, he has a very kind of holistic view of life on our planet. I mean, looking at it as a living universe, right? Not a materialistic, old-fashioned point of view.
Exactly, yeah. He's just actually published a paper a couple of days ago called Is the Sun Conscious? In the Journal of Consciousness Studies. So.
I know you like to make music out of nature, and you've used field recordings and natural soundscapes in your work. Can you tell us where that comes from and why you're drawn to the natural world as a source of making compositions?
It evolved from a number of threads. At the beginning, it was a form of journaling. I used to carry around a portable recorder and just record sounds wherever I went, and kind of like a sonic photography, I guess. And
yeah,
I'd listen to those recordings or make pieces of music out of them that would then summarize a particular time or time period or traveling. So it's a way of kind of collecting memories and encounters of places and stuff. But then I got much more interested in the kind of discipline of acoustic ecology. And how sort of soundscape studies or recordings of places can actually tell you a huge amount about the health of an ecosystem. In fact, a lot more often than just like a visual study or looking at a place, listening to a place, you can tell much more about the kind of health of the biodiversity. And also I was particularly interested, I just like this, there's a whole strain of electronic music called music concrete, or just the idea of recycling sounds and turning them into other things. There's something I like about the kind of resourcefulness of that. You can turn one thing into a completely different thing. And it just felt like a kind of a storytelling technique of weaving together places and moments and encounters. And then I got more and more interested in endangered and particularly in extinct and endangered sounds, and did a whole project sort of trying to track down recordings of extinct animals to make music from. But there's just much harder to find than endangered ones, obviously, because there's the microphone was only invented so recently, and then, you know, I mean, many animals have gone extinct recently, but it's just they're not often categorized in sound archives in terms of their sort of conservation status or their endangered nature or whether they're extinct or not. But yeah, all sorts, really. I just I think sound is a particularly underrepresented sort of medium or way of understanding the natural world or having insight into it. But it's increasingly becoming, in ecology is really beginning to recognize and take on board the power of sound as a vehicle for studying the natural world.
As a filmmaker, I believe that, you know, the audio is like 50% of the experience when I make films, you know, combining natural sound with music. I love that you called it sonic recordings. And your process actually is a lot of what I do. I mean, I'll just go out and, you know, whether it's by chance there's a rainbow, or by chance there's a storm cloud, or by chance, you know, there's an egret, you know, and I'll just, you know, shoot these pieces, but I don't have a preconceived idea of how that puzzle's all going to come together, you know, and I just have it by archive, as you must. When you feel like, oh, wow, I need that particular sound, or I want to weave that in, and you just, you know, that you have it in your archive to be able to use it. And for me, that's a beautiful workflow.
Totally. For me, it's like a kind of collage, almost like cutting and pasting and sort of assembling. Yeah. It's just a kind of form of composition that's just organizing and massaging things into place, basically.
And actually, you know, when you're actually creating it, you're doing the same thing as well, because you're layering, you know, different layers, different, you know, soundtracks on top of each other. Again, a collage. So you got a collage of, you know, recording sounds, and then you have a collage of playback where you put these sounds on top of each other, you know, weaving something that's really beautiful. So I was curious that, you know, I think you literally have used mushrooms to create some sounds and compositions. Can you tell me where that idea came from and how does that work?
Well, there's this machine. In fact, I have one here, but there's this amazing inventor. He built these, he was a friend of my dad's and in London and built these unbelievable devices. This is a kind of quite a rudimentary version of one. It's called a plant chant. And then these, it's a bioelectrical monitor basically. So these two, electrodes, you clip these onto onto a plant or a fungus or whatever it is, and then basically it just creates sound. So I can hear this an artist friend of mine called Mariana Hallman who's been making these boxes. So this is a wine cap mycelial.
Oh wow!
So this is wine cap fungus basically on a coffee substrate, And if I then basically turn this machine on and clip each of these contacts to these different pins going in there, then we should be able to hear the sound of the bioelectrical activity. So it picks up the electrical activity of the fungus. So let's have a listen anyway and see what happens.
Okay.
Oh, wow. That sounds great. You know, I worked on, you know, the first feature film I ever worked on, Cosmo, was The Secret Life of Plants, which decades ago, it was 1978 or 1980. And it was the very first time Stevie Wonder scored a movie. And in that particular film, the real, I think, inventor of this technology, I forgot the guy's name, but he was the one who invented the lie detector. You know, so that's where the technology comes from, being able to pick up these like variations of energy, you know, and they were able to apply that technology from, FBI, interrogator into the plant. That's where all that stuff started a long time ago. I know that, tell me about Wake Up Calls. You know, it's an album you wrote composing, you know, music recordings of endangered British birds. How did that come about? And what inspired you?
Well, I've been making music from birdsong for a while. I made a piece out of recordings of all of the British owls in about 2012, maybe as a present for my girlfriend, who painted me a picture of an owl and asked me to give her an owl back. So I basically made this piece by chopping up different recordings of the British owls, and it was meant to be a kind of lullaby, I guess. And then it evolved from there. I started writing a few different pieces for, I think it was one Christmas Eve. In fact, I needed to make some presents quite rapidly and ended up making a few customized alarm clock pieces from recordings of dawn choruses for my family and a couple of friends. And it kind of began there. And then, yeah, they all just came together and I was, yeah, just again, became interested in this, just shining a light on or highlighting some of the crazy rapid loss of habitats and loss of bird species and in all over the world. But I decided to particularly focus on the UK just because that's where I'm from and where I'm most connected to. But yeah, it just felt like a good way of highlighting this degradation. And then also, I mean, the aim is also to try and figure out a way slowly of, so each track on the record is kind of featuring or solo, like a different bird as the kind of soloist, or so they're named after all these different birds. And then as much as possible, I'm trying to figure out how to then use each of the money that's generated from those tracks. A certain percentage of each of those money will go back to that particular bird habitat or that particular conservation. So as a way of trying to, because especially when you're working with birdsong or any other animal song for that matter, I'm just interested in what the rights issues around that. And it's just, you can't pay them publishing royalties in the same way that you can pay another human being publishing royalties. And then, so, I mean, which I think obviously when the birds are such glorious musicians themselves, and a lot of the character of these recordings is very much from the birds. So, so I'm just trying to figure out how to come up with a way in which you can, that the music can also then funnel energy and sort of money back into the various conservation initiatives around each of these sort of birds or the habitats that they sort of survive and thrive in. So yeah, that's a little bit about Wake Up Calls, just an attempt to engage in a kind of multi-species conversation and help.
I think that's great. I mean, I never thought about the fact that there is no recording association for royalties for animals or elements of nature that deserve to get some kind of profit participation. I think that's pretty cool.
I mean, I've been following quite closely. Have you seen that whole thing about the monkey took the selfie and that they basically decided that animals couldn't own intellectual property rights, essentially because they don't, obviously, like the courts decided that animals weren't conscious enough or, and so, I mean, obviously there's also more subtleties because the photographer said he set the whole thing up and the monkey just pressed the button, which obviously gave him, but the basic court ruling was more on the idea that basically only a human being could have an intellectual property right. And I personally disagree with that. And I just think that, you know, when yeah. what how we define culture and intellectual property needs to expand, I think, incorporate a lot, you know, there's this beautiful book I've been reading called The Cultural Lives of Whales and Dolphins, which is talking about how whales and dolphins, just among many other creatures, but just like have to have a sort of form of cultural transmission, which they've just been analyzing the records of the whaling ships in the North Pacific. And basically when they first started whaling in the North Pacific, over a period of about three or four years, there was a huge decrease in the actual harpoon strikes that were hitting the whales. And it's because the whales very rapidly learned that to escape the human beings, they needed to swim upwind. Whereas before that, their main defense tactic was to gather with their heads in the middle and their tails on the outside, because their main, the sperm whale's main predator was the killer whale. And so that was their defense mechanism for that. But the pace at which these techniques spread among the whale community meant that it had to be transmitted by some form of communication. It couldn't have been inherited across generations. Anyway, so that's just one example of many, and birds obviously are similar in their language is socially acquired. And you raise a bird in isolation, it has a much more impoverished kind of vocabulary, basically. So I think, given all these things, I think it's time that we certainly expanded our ideas of so-called intellectual property and the ways in which we can incorporate these creatures into some sort of royalty structures.
Yeah, there's been some, like, you know, court cases in the United States where, you know, these large primates, you know, were being in cages, and the argument was, you know, that they have certain rights. I mean, we give corporations rights. Why wouldn't we say that, you know, a primate, you know, like a, you know, chimpanzee or something, wouldn't have similar rights? And that's been, you know, some lawyers are trying to work that all the way up to the Supreme Court. But I think it's quite true. Again, it's that arrogant, narrow point of view, this human-centric point of view, that we're the only conscious beings, you know, on the planet. So, you know, I know you're also working on another album with interspecies, blending birds and other animals. I mean, let's talk about that. And maybe perhaps you could even, you know, place some examples of what you're doing. That would be great.
Well, I can show you a little bit about how I make some of the sounds. Or this is a nightingale. I'll play you a little snippet of a nightingale recording, which I made in Kent, which I then turned into a kind of a keyboard, basically, kind of like a prepared piano. Or so I took about four or five different extracts of the nightingale song, and then spread it across a sampler, essentially. So each extract will be stretched over about five or six different notes, and then so if you play a big chord, you end up with all these different. Anyway, that's sort of that's kind of how, and then you just I'll slowly kind of assemble or layer up bits and bobs, and
yeah.
So that's some nightingale song, and then this is the recording of a bittern. And then let me see what else I've got. I've got a robin. And then this is an owl on the bass. And then, I mean, on and on and on, basically. It's a cuckoo. This is quite a fun one. So this is a recording of a longhorn sculpin. And then some humpback whales. And then these drum sounds. This is an oyster toadfish. And this is recorded by the American military during the Cold War, where so they armed their submarine pilots with sound banks of fish recordings, so they could tell the difference between Soviet submarines and fish in case they got confused. This is a buck-toothed parrotfish.
And do these recordings go through some type of like synthesizer that manipulates them a little bit?
I mean, not really. I mean, the only thing that's changed in any of them is just slowing them up and speeding them down. That's basically the only thing that I'm changing, other than potentially sometimes EQing them a bit or taking some of the lows or the highs out. But I mean, this is basically what they sound like. That's just what an oyster toadfish sounds like. And a buck-toothed parrotfish goes around sort of with a beak crunching up coral. And I mean, there's, let's see, there's a humpback. You can hear it. So the only thing changing there is just slowing the same sound down and speeding it back up again, basically. And then this is a blue whale. Anyway, so that's some of the sounds I'm working with currently for the ocean music.
So Cosmo, let's have a listen of how you've blended all these incredible animal sounds together.
Great. This is one of the tunes from the Wake Up Calls.
Together on my moving art series, you scored the Galapagos episode. Tell me, like, what was that process like, and how maybe the imagery inspired your composition?
Well, it was really fun, actually. It was some just extraordinary footage. Tried to treat the whole process almost like making a ballet or something, and working with the animal basically as dancers, really. And so I saturated myself in lots of ballet music. The flamingos, there's a great scene of the flamingos doing those amazing dances, and I'd watch them moving around, and I'd just try and accompany them essentially in their movements as if it was choreographed in some form of dance. And so yeah, I just try as much as possible, tried to be inspired from the movements or the feeling, or the giant tortoise kind of plodding along. Just really kind of thought about it like a ballet.
There's a really beautiful, playful, kind of quirky style, I think, that you approached in scoring that. I mean, it's certainly 180 degree different than a BBC documentary score would be.
Definitely. I mean, I've always actually found it quite maddening how the kind of general natural world kind of film, a lot of the BBC scores to some of their stuff, they're either completely over the top or just really monotonous. And like, I love the BBC. I love all of those nature documentaries. I don't mean at all to have a bad word against them. I watch them all and love them all. But I feel like there's a lot of room to explore the musical angle there, which doesn't just fall down the classic kind of orchestral kind of filmic sort of score. So I think there's a lot of room to play, basically.
Totally. I mean, well, I think you're sort of stuck in a formula of what, you know, natural history, you know, film should be in the story. I've always kind of, just rejected this, automatic knee-jerk reaction that it's always about predator versus prey. You know, there's always a setup that something's in danger, something's about to get eaten or killed. because that creates quote unquote drama or ratings. And they feel that's always like a necessary ingredient in it. Whereas I'm sure that the work that you're aware of that, you know, that even, you know, your dad, even Merlin talks about, there's a grand story of cooperation in nature, of interconnection that is, you know, not based on kill or be killed, but based on relationships and symbiosis. Anyways, those are the films that, you know, obviously I like to make. And in Galapagos, we had no, it was a journey without any killing or, and that kind of old-fashioned drama.
Yeah, no, I think often they're overly storied, or they try and set up some protagonist and then a sort of danger and a threat. And I think we're obviously things in reality are a lot more complicated than that. Obviously, there isn't, you know, for a prey animal being hunted, that's obviously a big part of their life. But in terms of this, just the subtlety of the relationships of in between species, they're just often way more complicated.
Not only more complicated, but more, I think it's more interesting, you know, because of that. Learning about a network, for me, is more fascinating than learning about, a predator versus prey type of relationship. Because, as you say, it is so much more complex, but also has these moral values where, you know, life flourishes when there is cooperation and that everything is interconnected. And that to me, I think, is a good moral lesson for how humans could, you know, live their lives.
Absolutely. And also, if you look at the consequences of seeing the legacy of a certain kind of interpretation of Darwin and how it's sort of mapped onto human culture, and you know, it's incredibly damaging. It sort of essentially tries to naturalize capitalism and competition, which is you know, just deeply problematic, and trying to kind of look to the natural world to kind of justify some of these very human-made, highly artificial structures and cultural practices is a very dangerous thing indeed. But so it's refreshing to see this whole kind of new biology, this new kind of much more, yeah, this with this greater awareness of symbiosis and collaboration and interspecies kind of dense interspecies relationships that and reliances that actually are what I think more fundamentally underpin the kind of the natural world.
Let's talk a little bit about music for healing. I know you composed the music for a series of Samuel Beckett plays at the Young Vic for Relax and Dream, a project that gave soothing music and nature videos to kids in hospital and hospice. Can you talk about the importance of music and natural imagery for people, especially children, in the hospital as part of a healing process?
Well, it was a great project, basically doing exactly that, just realizing there were, you know, all these kids' hospitals and hospices where a lot of the people in these wards, you know, they're highly sterile environments, sealed windows, as most hospital spaces are. And for kids that have these, you know, they're in there for sometimes years, if not forever, or, you know, it's just been demonstrated time and time again that just exposure to sort of natural imagery and recordings of even just listening to birdsong is just hugely beneficial for mental health. And so just the project was just all about trying to bring a little bit of that outdoor world and into these highly clinical spaces. And the woman who was, she went to all these beautiful sacred places all over the British Isles, basically, and recorded these just very slow, very simple, single shot, more or less, or just incredibly slow moving imagery, basically, of very immersive of all these different places. And then I just scored some just very simple kind of music along to it to just accompany it. And so, yeah, just attempting to kind of throw the window open into these very magical parts of the world and give people access to those spaces who just absolutely couldn't have access to them, basically.
Yeah, I see that happening, you know, more and more. I mean, actually on our movie art series, which, you know, you did the episode with Galapagos, I've had comments from parents saying that they had a major breakthrough with children with autism, and teenagers who were suicidal said that it saved their life. And many comments with people suffering from anxiety, depression, you know, about to go into surgery or out of surgery, all the way to end of life anxiety. So it's amazing that, you know, these programs, which are on Netflix, which don't proclaim at all to be a healing modality, end up getting all these comments where people suggest that they are a healing modality. And that's been an inspiration for me to bring that into healthcare. As a matter of fact, yeah, I mean, this is pretty remarkable. Like 2 weeks ago, there's a clinical trial just launched here in Santa Monica at the Pacific Neuroscience Institute, where I created like a 40-minute video that's shown on an 85-inch TV with music and headphones in a clinical trial to treat alcohol addiction, combining my imagery with psilocybin to treat people that are suffering from alcohol disorders. So it's slowly moving in the right direction. And it'll be interesting to see the results of the study.
Totally. Well, I'm fascinated. I'll be very curious to hear about that. Yeah. There's a kind of time in medicine, at least in England, where the doctor might prescribe you some fresh air or send you to the seaside or something like that. And hopefully it's moving back in that direction where people get prescribed a dose of the outdoors and be sent into a kind of wild place for a little while. Because I mean, it's really effective. It really works.
Yeah, absolutely. And if people don't have that opportunity, then bringing, you know, visual energy and sound energy into a room where perhaps they don't have that opportunity, then why not? And as a matter of fact, like the recordings you've captured are things you wouldn't normally ever hear. I mean, you would never hear the sound of a whale underwater, nor would you ever be able to be scuba diving and see a whale underwater. Yet we can bring that sacred rhythm, pattern, energy into the built environment. And especially with children, I think that's a miraculous healing modality. That's pretty remarkable.
And it's, I mean, with microphones and field recording, some of the fun is basically being able to take your ears and put them somewhere else. And for the last year, I've been working in this studio in a little cottage in Dorset off the grid with a little diesel generator and having to sort of power everything from solar panels. But just outside my studio is this big bird feeder, and I've been sellotaping my two tiny little microphones into the hedge and then running long cables back into my studio and just sitting there with the headphones on, essentially with the microphones functioning as my ears, and just listening to the birds just cleaning their beaks from like right next to them or flapping around me as if I was literally amongst them. And so the remarkable thing about microphones and camera technology is that you can transport your head and ears and your senses into this place that you could actually just, they'd never let you go, basically. And the birds would be too scared to carry on if you were sitting there with your head on the bird table. So that's part, I mean, for me, part of the kind of magic of field recording and as a kind of practice, or even, I mean, the more I've done it, the more it's become a kind of meditational practice, because just the second you have some microphones, turn them on and put the headphones on, it's, you suddenly kind of, you're bathing in this sound world that you otherwise wouldn't be aware of. It's because microphones don't differentiate like ears do. Like if you're sitting around a really noisy environment, you can kind of focus in or focus out of different aspects of it, whereas microphones just amplify all of it at once. And so you just, it's this incredible practice of having to learn to listen to everything at once. And it's just, I recommend it to anyone who has the ability, even with a phone. I mean, it's just like, turn the microphone on the phone, plug your headphones in, and just it's a completely different way of, and also because you can turn the gain up, so you can kind of expand your ears way beyond your normal hearing range. And just sitting there in a woodland or anywhere, just listening to the wind in the trees or something, it's just, for me, it's just become a really crucial sort of practice and something like that.
I love the fact that you refer to it as a practice, you know, because I've told many people that, you know, the fact that I have time-lapse cameras going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 4 decades is my practice. I don't have a formal meditation practice, but the mechanical aspects of what you have to do to make it work reminds me a little bit of like the sort of the structure that other practices have, whether it's prayer or chanting in order to get to a certain place. I mean, every morning I wake up and first thing I do is I go to my time lapse room, and I look at what happened last night. And did the flowers open? Did it move? Did it in frame? Is it out of frame? And then, you know, being able to either be joyful that I got a great shot or make an adjustment. It's a beautiful way to start my day, you know. to be able to do that dive. And I like the fact that there is a mechanical aspect to it. You know, it isn't just like, oh, there you are. You know, there's a certain skill and craft to what you're doing, you know, with recording sound. You get better at it every day, you know, over and over. You learn trial and error. And so it's a beautiful way to approach it as a meditative practice, because it does make you present, right? And that's the goal of any meditative practice, is to become present.
Absolutely. No, I couldn't agree more. It's become very important to me.
So you mentioned that, like, you know, you're doing some of these recordings, like, in this cabin somewhere off the grid. And are you connecting your electric instruments to solar panels so you can play outside and be totally powered by the sun?
Well, more or less. I mean, out of necessity for the last year, I've been living in this cottage that basically the only electricity that we have there is just when the diesel generator turns on in the evenings when it gets dark, basically. So for the last year, most of the electricity I've used to make music and a lot of the wake-up calls were finished there. And I had to buy a big battery and then a bunch of solar panels. And for the last year, most of the music I've been making has been solar powered, which is also incredibly satisfying. And then taking that equipment outside and performing some of those sounds back to the environments where I recorded the sounds, all powered by this little battery that's been charged up by the sun. It's a lovely kind of feeling of this kind of closed loop, really. Just to be able to kind of power. And also in doing that, I've become incredibly aware of how much power different things take, and turn anything I'm not using, I have turn off, because I'm constantly calculating what's in and what's out. So I've I've just moved into this new studio, and it's the first time I can ever just leave stuff on, which is also, you know, it has its benefits too, because you don't have to kind of unplug and replug everything in the whole time. But it's been a massive lesson, certainly over the last year, thinking a huge amount about where your electricity comes from, how much you've got. And also planning, I'd have to, the slightly downside is that on really nice days, I have to take advantage of the sun and work. I have to work more when it's sunny, and on wintry kind of cold days, you just have to plan a lot more when you can really put time and energy into things, and try and be economical and ecological at the same time.
Yeah. But again, another example of how it makes you more present, you know, like, it does matter, like, what the weather is like, and you do care about looking up at the sky and adjusting your, you know, your plan, your behavior. I think it's really beautiful. Plus, you're also learning this giant lesson about sustainability, you know, which is the most important, you know, challenge the human species needs to address, you know, in the immediate future, especially even coming out of this pandemic. How do we create, you know, practices, behavior that is sustainable? Because if we don't, then we will be in trouble.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what's your next big dream?
That's a good question. I mean, at the moment, I'm trying to develop a... one of the things I'm really interested in is making music. Essentially, we hear the world in a polyphonic way. When through listening to, you know, field recording and listening to the natural world, there's so many voices coming all at once from so many different places. So I've been trying to think of how to make music that kind of reflects that more than, I mean, not just for a stereo setup. Trying to make music that feels or could immerse us more in the world in the way that we actually hear, left to our own devices. So I'm trying to essentially explore developing a system using phones that can then connect to little speakers or not. And then I can make music for multi-channel music that people can then sync up and stream on their phone in big groups. I've been trying this out a little bit, and I've done a couple of experiments. But yeah, making polyphonic bird music, or not just bird, but the ones I've been doing so far, I've been kind of using bird song. And then big groups of people then stream them through their phones plugged into speakers or not, and you can create these massive DIY kind of multi-channel sound systems, essentially. So that's one of the things I'm trying to develop, is just the technology to do this, and also to make them sort of perfectly in sync without any kind of delay between the different sections. So that's one thing. But yes, just thinking more about how the music I make could actually better reflect the way that we listen to sounds or from the natural world. And it's basically, yeah, trying to make more ecological music, essentially.
Well, keep doing it. I never realized how similar your process is to my process, you know? It's really beautiful that you're clearly on a mission to, you know, save species and, you know, shift consciousness by being able to have people hear things that they've never heard before, to be able to feel things that they've never felt before. And I think by doing that, you get people to fall in love with it and therefore protect it without having to go into a diatribe of the scientific data as to the degradation of the planet, because that sometimes makes people feel unempowered and numb. They don't know what they can do. But if you can get people to want to protect it, that by far, I think, is the greatest environmental action you can take.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. What about you? What are you working on?
Oh my God. Well, let's see. Well, we've been like really working hard on marketing and distributing Fantastic Fungi globally. It actually did open up in London, and it, you know, with COVID, it was a little bit challenging to be in theaters. But we have a virtual summit coming up in September, which I'm very excited about. You'll be able to go into like 6 or 7 mushrooms. One might be like music, culinary, psychedelics, you know, presenters. I've learned a lot about virtual collaboration over the last year and a half, because that's what the whole world has had to do. And I, you know, again, it kind of mirrors the mycelial network in many ways. So I find that to be inspiring. And because I've been, it's been difficult to go out and film or travel around the world to all the sacred places that I would love to do, I've been just like doing what you're doing. I've been diving into my archive, and I'm working on a project tentatively called Moving Earth, where I want to tell the story of life from the tiniest microbe, you know, up through, you know, plants and animals and the human species. So just leveraging the material that I have, we're putting together a beautiful, you know, journey that'll be, I think, again, without narration, so that people can like enjoy the ride and let their own voice come through. So it's been kind of great, because I know that this period has been important for many people to be more introspective, right? Regardless of what you're doing, you've been forced to be introspective. If you can't travel on the outside, you got to travel on the inside, right? So given the fact that I had this large library, I've been waiting. You know, I've always been kind of postponing. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. You know, I'm kind of like a squirrel saving his nuts in a tree. And now I finally get a chance to like dive into it and open up those nuts and see what's inside. And like what you're doing is, you know, I just capture things that connect with my soul without a plan as to how I'm ever going to use it. And then it's amazing how you do have this inner voice that guides you at the moment that you're doing the composition, and it says, use this, try that. And after a while, it takes on an energy of its own. It's like a baby that grows up, and you kind of start that process, and pretty soon it's on stage performing. So anyway, I'm really grateful for sharing your thoughts and your music, the extraordinary soundscapes that you're doing. And we look forward to more collaborations together, as well as, you know, spreading your music throughout the world. It's important more than ever that you're able to, I think, capture these magic moments, magic sounds, and to be able to share them with people, which is really, really extraordinary.
Yeah, and particularly when so many of them are increasingly endangered. So that's the thing, they're sort of, you know, rarer and rarer. So it's like, it's important to kind of,
absolutely,
to work with them while they're still around.
Well, thank you for that. And also want to be able to thank my team. I want to thank Leland, Annie, Courtney, and Sarah for Moving Art, and Bethany, Ron, and Deanna from Magical Threads, for helping me produce today's podcast. I wish everybody can, you know, from what they've heard today, I think the big takeaway is just becoming more present. And it's pretty easy to do that if you just try to open your eyes and your ears and just be aware of, what am I hearing? And what does it sound like? And how does it make me feel? So thank you, Cosmo. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today.